So, Jim, you mentioned that you were in the Navy. You were an aerial photographer.
Yeah.
When were you in the Navy?
I was in right after high school. I graduated from Holyoke High School in Massachusetts, Holyoke, Massachusetts, in 1946. And that was just at the end of World War II. And the services had discharged so many people that they needed to rapidly rapidly attract people, and they offered a 2-year term. Ordinarily, Navy is 4 years. I don't know how much the Army is, but they had a 2-year term, and for that you got the GI Bill of Rights, which was a wonderful thing for so many Americans. So I went into the Navy in June 1946, and I got out in 1948. Actually, at 22 months, they didn't need people. They had solved the problem of having enough of a sizable Navy and Army for those years right after the war, when they discharged huge numbers. But I was an aerial photographer stationed in Alaska, Kodiak, Alaska, and then in California at San Diego Naval Base and Miramar Air Base with Photo Squadron 1. But I didn't ever get to do too much aerial photography. In fact, when I was on an aircraft carrier off of San Diego, and I did do photography of covering accidents, airplanes crashing or on takeoff or landing on the aircraft carrier. And then when I was assigned to the Photo Squadron 1, I only had 4 or 6 months left on my enlistment, so they made me captain of the coffee pot so that I wouldn't disturb the flight skins' pays of the guys that were had longer times to serve. So I became an expert on making coffee for those last 4 months.
Yes, and so you also mentioned that you were employed through the Youth in Action program. Was that directly after the Weeksville project, or it sounds like it was at the beginning?
Yeah, it was at the beginning. It was the way I earned some money,
Okay.
because in the beginning, I didn't have much. I had no income, and I'd spent all my savings in London on the School of Oriental Studies program that I messed up. And what was the question now?
When you were employed with the Youth in Action, I just want to get a clear timeline of.
Oh, let's see, it would be probably about 67 to 69, I think, in that
Okay.
area. It was like as a contract employee. I think I got $100 a week or something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, it was enough to keep going. But for most of the Weeksville early effort, it was as volunteer, much as Joan had to do at different times when she couldn't find funding. Joan stayed a long time, 20 or 30 years, really almost until her death, in I think about 2004. And she often had no salary. She used her own resources to get by. And that was the story of Weeksville, and we had people like Joan that would do that. Joe Haynes, of course, had a job, but there were a lot of people that put a lot of time in that did it entirely as volunteers. Mm-hmm. It was rare that we had enough money to hire assistants like they now have in Weeksville, you know, a full-time staff, and supported by the city mm-hmm. on city funds. But that was Joan's great project, to great aim, great goal, to get regular funding for the Weeksville effort.
Okay.
And finally she succeeded mm-hmm. a couple of years before she died.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned how the scout troops and children from local schools were involved in helping compile information about the houses that were being demolished.
The school, I think it was PS 234, and the scout troop was 342. The numbers were possibly interchanged. Anyway, the school, a successor of Colored School Number 2, in a modern successor, was right there opposite what became the Weeksville Houses, public housing project on the Model City site in block 1340, I think. So the school was right opposite, and it had a fancy name initially, Isaac Newton, or one of the great names of history. International history. But it, too, was changed to the Weeksville School as a result of our doing the project there. And a lot of the kids that were in Scout Troop 342 were students, pupils in that school. And Wilson Williams, I don't think he had, I forgot where he had worked. But he didn't live in, he lived nearby, not in the Albany Houses, but the scouts had their room in the Albany Houses, where I had originally worked as a volunteer trying to strengthen the tenants organization.
Okay. How did the scouts assist with the Weeksville?
Well, they were, you know, like any scout group, they get a willing scout leader, master, like Wilson Williams. And I don't think there's much in the way of funding for scouts. It's been pretty much a volunteer organization.
Okay.
I tried to be a scout, but I only got to Cub Scout status in Holyoke, Massachusetts.
How do you think the scouts were impacted by the Weeksville Project?
Oh, I think they liked the notice they got. I'm sure they got on some of the television programs. There's a television station, public television station in Boston. I don't know, it's quite well known. And they came to New York to do a series of programs for the Board of Education. And they came to Weeksville. The name of the overall name of the story, if you live in a city, where do you live? And I think our unit was called In Time. So they were interested in showing, you know, how within a urban community there were remains of something that had existed a long time ago. And so they came and photographed the kids digging, and I forgot who they had some big names involved. The name Joe Frazier, wasn't he the boxer that died last week?
Yes.
Seems that his name, that they had one or two of those, you know, well-known names involved. And we usually got copies of any programs that were done. We tried to get copies of any television broadcast or radio broadcast. And I contacted the archivist of that Boston station. And for some reason, we could never find copies of that particular series of TV, public TV mm-hmm. programs.
Okay.
And it's still a mystery. I don't know why they didn't keep mm-hmm. something. I went through the Board of Education and then to the actual National Archivist for public television.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it's the most well-known of the Boston public television stations. And I can't remember the W something. And that would have been a nice one to have, because they came and photographed the kids digging on. There was a hill, I think we called it the Troy Hill. It was right behind a row of wooden structures that had existed on Troy Avenue. And behind, there was a hill, and we dug there, and we found a cistern. What had held water in long ago, and it had been filled in, and a fellow named a kid, maybe 15 or 16, named Richard Lash, he was one of the neighborhood youth corps workers in the summer I had them, maybe 15 or 20. And that was where we felt we knew that there was something there. And one noontime, early in the digging by this crew of neighborhood youth corps boys, this Richard Lash, he had a speech impediment. And he and the other kids made fun of him. So he was not one of the group that were, you know, shooting the breeze.
Mm-hmm.
He was digging with a trowel, and he came across a circular row of stones.
Okay.
And that was the edge of this cistern. And he started finding things, including a little doll, a porcelain doll. And as soon as we hadn't found anything up to that point, and as soon as he started, you know, showing this little thing he'd found, which was not of great interest to boys, but mm-hmm. it was something that was from the past. And they all sort of took over and shoved him away. And so then the other guys were finding whatever else
mm-hmm.
was in that. There were dishes and marbles, Bennington marbles, and coins, an occasional coin. Not treasures, but definitely signs of a community from the past,
mm-hmm.
from 50 or 100 years before. And that was one of the greatest stories, Richard Lash. I had him on a radio program once, and ordinarily he couldn't talk very well.
Mm-hmm.
But on that program, I remember he had met Shirley Chisholm, we were in various, we had various sites, and New York Community College had taken us in under a grant from the chancellor of the City of New York University, City University of New York.
Okay.
And we had a big exhibit there in the library, and Shirley Chisholm had been there, and she'd met Richard Lash, who I always brought out as, you know, an outstanding example of how the project had helped, and he was able to talk to her, and then on the radio program, he clearly was able to describe his role, not in many words, but clear enough words, and that was a great thrill to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was maybe a high point of my experience at Weeksville. I actually went to his house, and his family or parents didn't seem all that interested in, you know, doing anything to get him help for the speech impediment, and I regretted that I couldn't do more. So I was unable to find a way of doing something, but I hope that his life was helped by him having the spotlight for a brief moment. So, what's your next question?
Why is the rediscovery of Weeksville important?
Why is it important? Well, I suppose it was important because it pointed to another existence of a small community of Afro-American people in the mid-19th century, and there were other projects around the country, and there have been many since then, but it was one of the first using archaeology and regular historical research to point up that there had been a community which had middle class people. There was a doctor and people that ran businesses, and it sort of highlighted a middle class that was pushed. It was another, you know, thing that was maybe pushed a little hard by press or enthusiastic volunteers. I don't know, it was a middle class community, but it was a community which had middle class people, and we eventually found descendants of some of them. Susan Smith McKinney was the doctor. She was one of the first women doctors in New York, black women doctors in New York. There was a sea captain, and I think it was her family that had a journal of this sea captain, captain of a small ship, I think. And we took pictures of that and recorded them on tape, and I think Weeksville still has the recordings. So I guess that was the main importance, and eventually, when Joan was the director, I was the director only in the early phase. Then they made me president of the new, really Dolores pushed to make me president. I didn't go for it, and later it became an issue with when some people objected to a white person being the president of an essentially black historical society, and they brought me up on charges, sort of, at Shirley Chisholm's office, but we survived it, because Dolores, not that she has a big mouth, but she and Elsie Richardson, they do have a way of speaking that's, I think there's a way of mentioning grassroots people who can tell it like it is. And Barbara Jackson and Robert Swan were at this sort of court-martial in Shirley Chisholm's office. Barbara Jackson was a later director of the Weeksville Project at City Community College of the City University. And there had been a little negative publicity about me from G2 Weusi. Do you know that name at all?
No.
Les Campbell was a leader of the radical, or at least radical black group in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. And he had a newspaper or newsletter, and I got in it as a white honky that was involved with Weeksville, even though I'd once worked for him at Pratt Institute in a summer program called Campaign Culture for high school students going into a university setting. And I did the tours for him. He was one of the leaders of the Ocean Hill Brownsville strike in the public school system, and later became a prominent activist. So it wasn't a serious threat, but it did result in this. Robert Swan was the researcher that Wilson Williams had brought in to our early Weeksville project, a very good researcher, and eventually got a master's and maybe a PhD based on, partly at least, on his Weeksville research. And he did produce some publications, and, but he eventually sort of turned against what he called the ladies' group of Weeksville. And Barbara Jackson had a PhD in something, and but she was some oriented toward the left, and radical. So I got along with her all right, but I was out of it by then, except that I was still president of the group. After the court-martial, I didn't resign until after that. I had really no interest in becoming part of a cause. Mm-hmm. And I resigned, not as a result, because we won the court-martial thing. And but I did resign from the presidency that I'd held a couple of years, because it was sort of embarrassing for me, who'd been the director of the project and then the president of the board of directors after being director of the project. So I was in a position where I was at control, some sort of control or power over the new director of the project. So it was not a good thing to be in. Mm-hmm. And it was uncomfortable for Barbara Jackson, and uncomfortable for me too. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was one of our, you know, clumsy times. Mm-hmm. And that was before Joan became the director of the of the society.
Okay.
I can't remember the timing of it all.
Okay.
I think, what if Joan became president? I can't remember. Can't remember. Okay. Somebody will have to put it together. And I just wasn't, I was working for the Long Island Historical Society by that time, from 1970, yeah, from 70 to 78.
Okay.
I was employed by the Long Island Historical Society. I was still the president for part of that period, but I can't remember. We had several project directors, Rodney Toner, I think, and Barbara Jackson. And anyway, that's a detail that you
okay.
don't perhaps need to know the exact.
Right. Right. So you said you were called in by Shirley Chisholm because Robert Swan and Barbara Jackson had concerns over you being...
Being president of an organization that was essentially Black history.
Okay.
And it came out that Shirley Chisholm said that I'd been elected by the organization and she couldn't undo that. And she didn't see any other reason, you know, for trying to get rid of me, because I had been, you know, in touch with her all along, and she'd helped us get grants and mm-hmm. so forth. So I had good relations with her. And Barbara Jackson, I don't think, had much in the way of relations with her. And Robert Swan was the researcher, but he just was not happy and with his role. And eventually somebody ought to record his recollection, because they'd be very different from mine. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody ever has, so I hope that Jennifer, whoever follows her, gets him before he passes on and gets his version of events of this period, you know, from, say, 1970 to 2000.
Okay.
Because I think it would be quite interesting to compare it with our, you know, what Joan has left and what I remember. And because Wilson, he was a friend of Wilson Williams. He was a physicist, that was his background when Wilson suggested we get him as a researcher. And we were gung-ho with hoping that he would, you know, get into the research heavily, and he did. His interpretations may not have always been what we would have liked, but they were important, and he was a great detail person.
Okay.
He went through newspapers, you know, one line at a time, and the old newspapers of Brooklyn in the Long Island Historical. And he was a thoroughgoing researcher. Whether he succeeded as an academic person, I just don't know. But relations, even with Joan, who was a very easy person mm-hmm. to get along with, were difficult.
Okay.
So someday, that I hope that he'll be interviewed and recorded to give his version of what happened
okay.
in those years.
Do you understand the perspective of people such as Barbara Jackson and Les Campbell and Robert Swan?
I'm not sure if I do or
okay.
not. You know, I feel they're important people, and their perspective should be honored, recognized, and recorded. I'd say that there was a little bias Les Campbell. I remember him. I worked, as I said,